Hello, this is Barbara, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the September 30th issue of the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Army works to overcome shortfall in recruiting. Program aims to pull up trainees who fall short of standards. By Sybil Mays Osterman and Tom Vandenbroek from the USA Today. Fort Jackson, South Carolina. Every Tuesday before dawn, hundreds of hopefuls line up with exposed midriffs to be weighed and measured at the South Carolina Army base, which takes in more recruits than any other. For course trainees, a drop in body fat could mean shipping out to begin a career in the Army within days. Otherwise, these future soldiers are consigned to another week working off the pounds. Anticipation and anxiety pervade as they file one by one past a desk where a drill sergeant informs each one of their fate. Some cheer for joy, others wipe away tears. Trainees like these, who wouldn't have made the cut a decade ago because of poor test scores or struggles with push-ups, now make up nearly a quarter of the U.S. Army's new recruits. For Brianna Flowers, 21, a 2-inch decrease in her waistline meant she would be en route to Army basic training within days. Leaving the line, she gushed about plans to indulge in the dining hall's French toast at breakfast and to break the good news to her mother. "It's exhilarating," she said. "It's all I've wanted." USA Today spent 3 days with prospective soldiers and drill sergeants to get a first-hand look at a key weapon in the Army's effort to defeat a recruiting crisis. The Future Soldier Preparatory Course aims to bring young people with academic and fitness challenges up to military standards. While the program has helped the Army meet its recruiting goals, it has raised questions about the quality of soldiers it's producing. Recruitment crisis spawns prep course. In 2022, as years of shortfall in recruiting numbers compounded into a crisis, the Army test launched the Future Soldier Prep Course, a boot camp-style program to quickly pull up recruits who don't meet academic or physical standards. That year, the Army's recruiting class had been 25% shy of its goal of 60,000 new soldiers. 3 years later, with the Army's recruitment crisis in the rearview mirror, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and others say young people are clamoring to serve under President Donald Trump. The fledgling Future Soldier Prep Course started during Joe Biden's presidency and has played a central role in reversing the recruiting slump. More than 46,000 soldiers have joined the Army through the Future Soldier Prep Course. It has produced between 20 and 24% of the Army's newly minted soldiers since the course's launch in 2023. Would-be soldiers in the program sleep in large open bays on bunk beds. At meals, they stock up on grilled chicken, cottage cheese, and vegetables as drill sergeants monitor their trays. Program leaders underscore that trainees are never ordered to put food back. They aim to avoid disordered eating behaviors. the Army barely clinched its recruiting goal of 55,000 in the last fiscal year. This year, it announced in June, 4 months early, that it had met its annual goal of 61,000 signed contracts. Hegseth has accused the military of lowering standards in the past and vowed to raise fighting standards. The future soldier prep course has not fallen afoul of the administration's anti-DEI agenda thus far. You need to be fit, not fat, sharp, not shabby, Hegseth told the Army War College in an April speech. Army Secretary Dan Driscoll said in an interview this summer that the course helps the Army maintain standards, not lower them. Every one of those soldiers that has come out of the Future Soldier Prep course has met that standard without us lowering it, he said. The course accepts recruits whose body fat is up to 8% higher or whose scores on the Army's aptitude test are as much as 7 points lower than the requirement to become a soldier. In the span of 90 days, they work intensively to bring down their body fat or bring up their academic scores, testing every week until they succeed. If they fail, they can try again after 6 months. Getting recruits up to standard isn't cheap. The Army will spend about $120, the Army will spend about $120 million this year and about $99 million in 2026 in this effort to fill its ranks. In Army recruitment, quality matters. Not all recruitment is equal. And the quality of recruits or how high they score on the Army's aptitude test can have implications for the military's level of readiness, according to Beth Ash, a military recruitment and personnel expert at the RAND Corp. Trainees who need academic help make up about 70% of the Future Soldier Prep course. Trainees on the academic track attend high school-like classes in math and word comprehension from about 9 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. daily. At a session in August, a teacher methodically jotted down equations with complex fractions on a whiteboard as trainees rhythmically recited aloud the steps of the process. Convert to an improper fraction, add across the top, divide by the denominator. Pentagon policy refers to benchmarks for quality that require at least 90% of the recruits to have a high school diploma. Recruits with the lowest scores on the military's aptitude test are assigned to what is known as Category 4. Recruits with test scores in the middle 61% fall into Categories 2 and 3, while the top 6% fall into Category 1. Category 4 recruits could make up no more than 4% of new troops. Each is required to attend the prep course, according to the Army, and about 90% of them become soldiers. The Army has been brushing up against the Category 4 limit since the recruiting crisis began. Data shows that the percentage of Category 4 recruits jumped from 2% in 2020 to 3.7% in 2021 and peaked at 3.9% in 2022, the year the pilot program for future soldiers debuted. In 2023, the figure was 3.56%. It dropped to 3.46% in 2024, and by July of 2025, it stood at 3.72%. Research suggests that soldiers with higher aptitude scores perform better on hands-on military tasks and have fewer behavioral and disciplinary issues, Ash said. However, data also shows that course graduates have performed equally or better in their Army careers than those who joined the service through the traditional route, according to Lieutenant General Brian Effler, the Army's top officer for personnel. He attributed that difference to the fact that soldiers in the prep course get a head start in what amounted to pre-basic training. Attrition rates for preparatory courses for preparatory course candidates are similar to the rates of their peers who joined the Army through the traditional route, according to the Army. More than 90% of those who sign up for the courses end up in the Army. Soldiers on the academic improvement track have performed slightly better than soldiers in the body fat reduction track. The way they would hold themselves compared to the other trainees, you can totally tell the difference between them, said Drill Sergeant Jeanette Paskey, who previously worked with soldiers at the beginning of their Army training before her work with the course at Fort Jackson. They had struggled more, but they still strived to be better. They have grit, and I think that's what the Army needs. Course graduates struggle, succeed. The courses, Effler said, have provided a huge nudge for young people who want to serve. If I didn't have the opportunity, I don't know where I would be right now, said Kylie Wainwright, a 23-year-old specialist stationed at Fort Hood, who entered the Army through the program. Growing up on a small family farm in New York, Wainwright was accustomed to physical work and lifting heavy weights, but her endurance was poor, she said. She lost a small amount of body fat over a week doing the course's intensive workouts before testing out to begin basic training. Nathaniel Aubin, 26, said he dropped from 265 to 240 pounds. Now a private first class stationed at Camp Buring in Kuwait, Aubin said he still struggles with his weight and staying within the Army's body fat requirements. Aubin entered the 101st Airborne Division as a helicopter maintainer less than 2 years ago with dreams of becoming a pilot. As the end of his contract approaches, Aubin, who is from rural Connecticut, said he is still mulling whether to stay in the Army or pursue his goals outside it as an aviator. I lost my path a bit, he said. Wainwright said there's still some social stigma within the Army's ranks attached to the course, which she said is colloquially called Army Fat Camp, sometimes by the trainees themselves. It's a little bit humiliating, she said. Months ago, the Army was forced to answer to a report from the Defense Department Inspector General, an internal but independent watchdog, which found that the program was admitting trainees with a body fat percentage far above its stated cap, as much as 19% higher than the requirement to begin Army basic training. Data showed that 14% of trainees above the body mass threshold were taking up the program's limited medical resources, leaving the rest at increased health risk, including the risk of death, according to the report. The program's academic component had also let its stated standards slide, and a significant portion of its Fort Jackson trainees had difficulty speaking or understanding English, the watchdog found. A sizable, but not significant, portion of academic trainees didn't speak English as their first language, according to Captain Matthew Ligowski, the fitness course commander. Some in the course still couldn't speak a lick of English, he said. The Army largely disputed those critiques, saying it already had a stringent process in place to weed out trainees who don't meet requirements. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The Why Wall of Motivations. In a room at Fort Jackson next to the paved outdoor area where trainees strain through sweaty workouts, one wall is covered and scribbled on sticky notes. Its official name, the Why Wall. Trainees' messages on those notes say, free college, get me and my kids out of a bad situation, to make my family proud, I needed money and couldn't find a job. I'm not a failure, another note read. For many hopefuls at Fort Jackson, the why is rooted in the struggles they left behind at home. Poverty, homelessness, sexual assault, and the loss of loved ones. My mom worked three jobs and I still send money back to help pay bills, said Diego Gutierrez Serrano, 18, who grew up in a small town outside Worcester, Mass. He saw the program as a path out of poverty and a way to avoid becoming another statistic like all the other kids. Leah Creech, 22, of Milford, Ohio, said she was the victim of sexual assault, a traumatic experience that led her to sign up for the course. I wanted to not only get my history back, but get my body, she said. Making sure I'm proud of myself every day, she said, tearing up. That's why I'm here. Boat retraces Erie Canal route. Seneca Chief replica marks 200th anniversary of journey. By Madison Scott of the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle. Buffalo Maritime Center's replica of the Erie Canal boat Seneca Chief arrived in Rochester on September 27th for its fourth port stop along its bicentennial voyage through the Erie Canal. The 33-day voyage commemorates the 200th anniversary of Governor DeWitt Clinton's inaugural journey from Buffalo to New York Harbor on the original Seneca Chief after the opening of the Erie Canal in 1825. The boat stop at Cornhill Navigation in Rochester was celebrated with a day full of community, music, speeches, and time honoring the trip's purpose, commemorating not only the canal's economic influence in the country, but also the cultural and environmental consequences it caused, according to the Buffalo Maritime Center. What is the Erie Canal boat Seneca Chief? The Erie Canal boat Seneca Chief is a full-sized replica of the original Seneca Chief, which was used during Clinton's historic journey through the Erie Canal in 1825. This replica boat was constructed by hundreds of volunteers from the Buffalo Maritime Center. Executive Director of Buffalo Maritime Center, Brian Trisiak, said the construction of the Seneca Chief spanned over 5 years with many challenges, including the COVID-19 virus. To see this culminating into this wonderful experience is something that is very, very hard to describe, Trisiak said. I think I've gotten all my tears out back in Buffalo, or typically I'd be crying at this time. It's just absolutely amazing. The Seneca Chief, which departed from Buffalo's commercial slip on the western end of the Erie Canal on September 24th, will dock at 28 ports along the Erie Canal and Hudson River before arriving at Pier 26 in New York City. Trisiak explained that the journey so far has been taxing with nonstop work, but that seeing different communities engaging and learning about the boat during their stops has made all the hard work worth it. When we show up at another location, you can just see all these people, and any tiredness, any sort of weariness that we have goes away, he said. Rock the Riverway Weekend, celebrating the bicentennial of the Erie Canal. The Erie Canal Bicentennial Voyage commemoration in Rochester began at 10 a.m. on September 27th at North Star Commons with the planting of a white pine, which is known as the Great Tree of Peace. This tree will be planted at each stop along the Bicentennial Voyage as a symbolic tribute to the Haudenosaunee who were displaced during the creation of the Erie Canal, which led to devastating changes in New York State's ecosystems that can still be felt today. Trish Corcoran, a teacher at the Harley School, spoke during the welcome ceremony and explained how the white pine represented the unification of the five nations into the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Every white pine planted along the bicentennial voyage, Cochran said, will stand as a symbol of peace and honor to those who lost their lives building the Erie Canal and the indigenous people who were illegally displaced during its construction. The canal was for commerce, but it was also a freeway to environmental devastation. Disease and invasive species were spread, extraction was increased, and genocide and removal of more indigenous nations further west was increased, she said. Water collected from each port's section of the Erie Canal or the Hudson River will be used to water the final tree when it is planted in New York City to symbolize the connections between these waterways in New York State. The Seneca Chief was greeted with a welcome ceremony at the Cornhill Navigation Landing, consisting of speeches and a welcoming Native peace song sung by the Harley School Children's Choir. After the ceremony, the crowd lined up along the Genesee Riverway to wait their turn to board and tour the boat. Celebrations continued throughout the day with live music from John Daddy, cruises along the Genesee River in the Cornhill Navigation's newest boat, the Riverie, and paddle shaping and wood carving activities held by staff from the Buffalo Maritime Center. This event is not only a celebration of the Erie Canal's incredible 200-year legacy, but also a chance for our community to come together along the riverway that connects us, Executive Director of Cornhill Navigation, Patrick Russell Walsh, said in a statement. The event concluded with a fireworks display over the Genesee River to commemorate the 200th anniversary of the Erie Canal and the inaugural voyage of the original Seneca Chief. Trans athlete challenges ban on competition. RIT sprinter cites Suni Ginesco NCAA for denying her entry. By Kyla Kane, Rochester Democrat and Chronicle. A transgender athlete has lodged a discrimination complaint against SUNY Geneseo, its athletic department, and the NCAA after she was prohibited from competing in women's races at a track meet earlier this year. Sadie Schreiner, a Rochester Institute of Technology sprinter, said SUNY Geneseo athletic officials denied her entry into the 200 and 400 meter races at the Geneseo Early Invitational in March. Schreiner was allowed to compete in the event in 2024, where she took first place in both categories. When she attempted to register for the 2025 competition, the school's track coach allegedly told Schreiner her participation would run afoul of a recent NCAA policy change that bans transgender women from competing in women's sports. If I were to not follow the NCAA meet procedures, it opens the meet up or event up to being invalidated for all competitors, head coach Chris Popovinci supposedly told Schreiner. He offered to let her compete in the men's division or in an individual exhibition category instead. Can transgender women compete in college-level sports? President Donald Trump in February signed an executive order barring transgender women and girls from competing in women's sports and directed agencies to withdraw federal funding from academic institutions that do not comply. One day later, the National Collegiate Athletic Association announced a partial ban on transgender athletes. Transgender women can practice with college women's teams, the governing body said, but are not eligible to compete. Transgender men are not prohibited from participating in men's sports. Schreiner was put under a national spotlight last year after competing in the 2024 NCAA Division III Outdoor Track and Field Championship. She placed last in the 400-meter race, but drew negative attention from critics of transgender athletes. After she broke several RIT records, teammate Carolyn Hill accused Schreiner of stealing accolades from other female competitors. Following the NCAA decision, Schreiner was dropped from RIT's track team. She continues to compete in some races as an unattached athlete, meaning she does not represent a school or a club. In a lawsuit filed in Livingston County Supreme Court, Schreiner and her attorney argued SUNY Geneseo's denial violated the New York Human Rights Law, which prohibits discrimination based on gender identity and expression. Officials from SUNY Geneseo declined to comment on the lawsuit, saying only that the school adheres to NCAA policy. In a statement, NCAA said the organization must ensure fair competition in all NCAA championships. Earlier this summer, Schreiner also sued Princeton University after she claims she was removed from a May women's race at the Larry Ellis Invitational because she is transgender. She is a vocal advocate of transgender athletes on social media. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Store Owner, Violence is Not My Problem by Kayla Kane and Curia Weaver from the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle. Because the city of Rochester has been under a state of emergency for 3 years, it can't close your store if trouble in the parking lot grows violent. You don't have to be the cause of the conflict. We learned this in interviews with a North Clinton Avenue business owner and an examination of the powers city officials wield under the state emergency law. Yasser Salih, the owner of Easy Inn Grocery at 886 North Clinton Avenue, feels like he suffered significant financial losses and business headaches, massive ones, since the city closed his store following a shooting on his corner. Hear why the store is open again and his perspective on the tension with the city in this northwest neighborhood of Rochester. In this video at the democratandchronicle.com. Syracuse University Chancellor from Irondequoit to step down by Steve Howe from the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle. The Chancellor and President of Syracuse University, who grew up in Irondequoit, is stepping down after one more year at the helm. Kent Siverud announced his departure will come after more than a dozen years in the role, with his intention to step down in June 2026. Siverud mentioned his long ties to New York in the statement, which highlighted his time at the university as the greatest privilege of his career. For more than 12 years, I have witnessed the people who make up this great university perform miracles every day. You have launched innovative academic programs, hired hundreds of new faculty, and advanced research addressing the world's biggest challenges, Siverud said. Syracuse University President Kent Siverud helped school through COVID. In the statement, the chancellor and president emphasized the university's record applications and enrollment, as well as the difficulties faced in navigating the COVID-19 pandemic. He also lauded the university for achieving balanced budgets and record fundraising, along with improvements to campus, like the revamped JMA wireless dome. There was controversy during his tenure, including a racist fraternity video and other scandals. Siverud is one of 12 individuals to head the university since its founding in 1870, beginning with Alexander Winchell. The first and only woman to hold the role was Nancy Cantor from 2004 to 2013. The university's Board of Trustees will select a successor over the coming year. The 9-member Board of Trustees is chaired by Jeffrey M. Scruggs, a managing director at Goldman Sachs. There is still more to do, and I am energized for this final year. We will continue advancing, building, and achieving together as one university, Siverud said. Amazon grocery ambitions stumble in British market. Retailer will close all of its fresh stores in UK by James Davey from Reuters. London, when Amazon opened its first grocery store outside the United States in 2021, its choice of a site in West London for a cashier-free store was seen as the start of a major assault on Britain's $290 billion food market. That store closed in 2023, and the group recently said it planned to shut its remaining 19 Amazon Fresh stores, a failure that highlights the brutal economics of UK food retail, and how one of the most powerful retailers in the world may still be feeling its way on how to compete globally in grocery stores. Amazon, which also runs Amazon Fresh stores in the United States, as well as the upmarket Whole Foods market chain, never confirmed UK store targets, but 2021 media reports suggested plans for over 260 fresh outlets by the end of 2024. Last year, it also dropped Amazon Fresh delivery in 5 cities, but still serves over 100 UK towns and cities, including London, Birmingham, and Manchester. It also ended its own grocery delivery service in Germany. Amazon's announcement does not impact its more than 60 Amazon Fresh stores and more than a dozen Amazon Go stores in the United States, or its over 539 Whole Foods Market locations across the United States and Canada, the company said. Plans to expand delivery. Amazon insists grocery remains a key part of its UK ambitions, its third biggest market overall after the United States and Germany. It said on September 23rd, it plans to expand UK online delivery of everyday essentials and fresh groceries through its main amazon.co.uk site. The Amazon Fresh site and partnerships with supermarkets Morrisons, Co-op in Iceland, and rapid delivery firm GoPuff, where orders are placed via Amazon's site but delivered by the retailers. Amazon plans next year to introduce perishable groceries on amazon.co.uk with same-day delivery, a service it recently launched in the United States. It will also convert 5 Amazon Fresh locations to Whole Foods Market format, giving it 12 stores by the end of 2026. But after over 15 years of selling groceries, analysts estimate Amazon's UK market share remains below 1%, despite its stock market value being over 60 times that of industry leader Tesco. Amazon does not publish financial results for UK grocery. According to interviews with former employees, rival executives, consultants, analysts, and academics, Amazon misjudged the challenge of adapting its global retail model to the nuances of UK food retailing, where 14 household names fight for margins under 5%. One former UK grocery retail CEO, who declined to be named, said building a mass food retail operation in Britain required a very different skill set from Amazon's general merchandise expertise, such as specialist logistics and systems. It's a volume game. Building scale is expensive, and the market is intensely competitive, he said. German discounters Aldi and Lidl took decades to turn sizable profits in Britain, while online supermarket Ocado is barely profitable 25 years after its founding. And U.S. retail giant Walmart bought Asda in 1999, but sold it in 2020, having failed to realize its UK ambitions. The market is dominated by Tesco, with a market share of 28.4%, according to World Panel data, ahead of Sainsbury at 15.1%. Aldi and Lidl have built a combined 18.9%. Amazon may have also misjudged British shoppers. It launched stores during a cost-of-living crisis, pushing checkout-free technology is a differentiator when consumers were forced on saving money. Issues with suppliers. Amazon's relationship with suppliers is another area where it has struggled. Consultants who have worked with Amazon suppliers say that, unlike other retailers, it doesn't make full checks when goods arrive, instead relying on automated product recognition. David Sables, CEO of Sentinel Management Consultants, which advises suppliers in their dealings with supermarkets, said that has led to a disproportionately high number of supplier disagreements with Amazon over the quantity of goods received, leading to delayed or incomplete payments. Amazon is being investigated by the industry regulator over alleged supplier payment delays and has been ranked Britain's worst performing grocer for compliance with a code of practice since 2022. Amazon said it takes the industry code seriously and plans to demonstrate its ongoing compliance. Future of online market. Amazon said on September 23rd it was closing Amazon Fresh stores in Britain because of the very substantial growth opportunities in online delivery. Martin Hubel, a former senior food category manager at Amazon, said the company's online tie-ups with supermarkets were more profitable, earning commission without bearing the cost of fulfillment. Amazon cited a report from PwC's strategy and that by 2030, Britons would conduct over 25% of their food spending online. But that looks optimistic. The online share of Britain's total grocery market peaked at about 15% during the COVID pandemic and was 13.4% in September, according to market researcher Nielsen IQ. Some investors turn to chatbots, AI fueling boom in robo advisory market, by Joyce Alves, Reuters. London, is ChatGPT nears its third birthday? At least 1 in 10 retail investors is using a chatbot to pick stocks, fueling a boom in the robo-advisory market. But even fans say it is a high-risk strategy that cannot replace traditional advisors just yet. Thanks to artificial intelligence, anyone can select stocks, monitor them, and obtain investment analysis that was once only available to big banks or institutional investors. The robo-advisory market, which includes all companies providing automated algorithm-driven financial advice such as fintech, banks, and wealth managers, is forecast to grow to $470.91 billion in revenues in 2029 from $61.75 billion last year, marking a roughly 600% increase, according to data analyst firm Research in Markets. Jeremy Leung, who spent almost two decades analyzing companies for UBS, has been using ChatGPT to chase stocks for his portfolio since he left the Swiss bank late last year. I no longer have the luxury of a Bloomberg terminal or those kinds of market data services, which are very, very expensive, Leun said. Even the simple ChatGPT tool can do a lot and replicate a lot of the workflows that I used to do, he said, cautioning that such a tool might, however, miss some crucial analyses as it can't access data behind a paywall. Lung isn't alone. The industry is growing fast and exponentially. About half of the retail investors say they would use AI tools such as ChatGPT, whose launch in November of 2022 ignited the AI boom on the markets, or Google's Gemini to pick or alter investments in their portfolio. And 13% of them already use these tools, according to a survey from Brooker E. Toro, which polled 11,000 retail investors across the world. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In the UK, 40% of the respondents to a survey by comparative company Finder said they have used chatbots and AI for personal finance advice. ChatGPT itself warns it should not be relied on for professional financial advice and says its owner, OpenAI, has not released data on the number of people who use its chatbot to choose investments. AI models can be brilliant, said Dan Maxulski, UK Managing Director at eToro, which boasts 30 million users worldwide. The risk comes when people treat generic models like ChatGPT or Gemini as crystal balls. Maxulski said it is best to use AI-generated platforms specifically trained to analyze markets, as general AI models can misquote figures and dates, lean too hard on a pre-established narrative, and overly rely on past price action to attempt to predict the future. Granted, U.S. stocks are around record highs, but stock picking using ChatGPT requires some financial knowledge, and its adopters say there is high risk of getting it wrong. Search for victims continues in Minnesota. In Michigan. Officials seek motive in deadly church shooting by Christopher Kahn and Kristen Jordan Shamus from USA Today. Law enforcement officials on September 29th were searching for more victims and piecing together what led an ex-Marine to launch a deadly attack on a church in central Michigan, killing at least four people and wounding eight others in what authorities are investigating as an act of targeted violence. Officials said Thomas Jacob Sanford, 40, rammed a truck bearing two American flags into the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Grand Blanc, a suburb of Flint. The attacker then got out of his truck, opened fire on hundreds of worshipers, and used gasoline to set the building ablaze, authorities said. Sanford was killed in a gunfight with police. Two people were fatally shot in the attack, and the bodies of two others were found hours later amid charred debris of the building. Of those injured in the shooting, one person was in critical condition and seven were listed as stable, authorities said. Grand Blanc Township Police Chief William Renier said first responders were still working to find more victims, adding that some people remained unaccounted for. "We're working tirelessly to find additional bodies," he said. "The entire church has not been cleared because it's a total loss due to the fire." The shooting was the latest to break out at a place of worship this year and comes after several high-profile targeted attacks. In August, a gunman opened fire at a Catholic church, and school in Minnesota, where hundreds of young students were attending Mass, killing 2 children and wounding at least 17 people. In the wake of the attack, President Donald Trump called for an end to what he described as an epidemic of violence in our country. The incident was also one of a dozen mass shootings in Michigan last year and the deadliest among 6 mass shootings reported in the United States over the weekend, including a shooting at a bar in North Carolina where a gunman fatally shot 3 people and wounded 8 others. Anti-LDS talking points. Sanford of Berto, Michigan, about 8 miles north of Grand Blanc, appears to have been a veteran of the U.S. Marines, according to his mother's social media posts and archived news reports. He did stints in Japan and Iraq after graduating Goodrich High School in 2003, according to a 2007 news article from the Clarkston News. About a week before the deadly shooting, the alleged gunman went on a tirade against the church and described Mormons as the Antichrist, according to Burton City Council candidate Chris Johns. Johns told the Detroit Free Press, part of the USA Today network, that he spoke with Sanford while he was canvassing in Burton. He described Sanford as outgoing, polite, and extremely friendly, and added that his animosity toward the church didn't seem violent. It was very much standard anti-LDS talking points that you would find on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, said Johns, who has spoken with local police and the FBI. Sanford is registered to vote in Burton, but available records do not show when he last voted. In Michigan, voters do not register by party. I know everyone who was there. Central Michigan residents expressed disbelief in the wake of the deadly shooting. I am very shaken up, Stephanie Giddings, whose daughter had recently been baptized at the chapel, told the Free Press, their family. Philip Cotter, a Clio resident, was a member of the Grand Blanc Church, but did not attend morning services the day of the shooting. I know everyone who was there, he said, choking up with emotion, as tears welled in his eyes. Mourners gathered on a football field shortly after the shooting to pray for the victims, their families, and those impacted by other violent incidents across the country. The vigil was planned weeks ago by the Genesee County Republican Party as a reaction to the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. The event, which was held on the football field of the Holy Redeemer Church of Burton, focused primarily on the deadly church rampage that broke out less than 10 miles away. Pastor Timothy Hicks of Christian Love Faith Center in Flint attended the vigil. He said he heard the news of the shooting while leading service at his own church and paused to lead his congregation in prayer for the victims. You can only imagine how devastating it is when you think you're in a place of safety, a place of worship, and then all of a sudden, lives are taken at the sound of a gunshot, Hicks said. Classes canceled, nurses barred. Multiple public school districts canceled classes and after-school activities on September 29th. We know this tragedy has weighed heavily on our students, staff, and families. The visible police activity throughout the community has created an understandable distraction and unease, said a statement from Goodrich Area Schools. We believe taking this day will allow space for healing and for families to be together. Meanwhile, nearly 750 registered nurses at Henry Ford Genesee's Hospital in Grand Blanc were on strike September 28th when the shooting took place. Some said they offered to help the hospital, but were turned away. In a statement to the Free Press, the hospital said it couldn't allow the nurses to assist for security and patient privacy reasons. The statement added that the hospital was able to care for the patients from the church tragedy without additional help. Dallas shooting victim shackled to bed. Wife decries treatment of ICE facility attack victim by Rick Jervis and Eduardo Cuevas, USA Today. Dallas. The last time Stephanie Goffini spoke to her husband, she was encouraged by the excitement in his voice. He was coming home. Miguel Angel Garcia Medina, 31, expected to be remanded to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. He had been arrested August 8th for driving under the influence and spent 6 weeks in Tarrant County Jail in Arlington, Texas. But the couple devised a plan that would keep them together even as the Trump administration stepped up deportation sweeps. Garcia had married Geffany and started a visa process to stay in the United States permanently. Together, they would raise 4 kids with a 5th baby on the way. He was feeling happy, Goffany told USA Today of the September 23rd phone call. He knew he would end up with ICE, but we had a plan to keep him in the U.S. That plan imploded the following day. Garcia had just been transported from Arlington, Texas, to the Dallas ICE field office on September 24th when a gunman opened fire on the building and the van with an 8mm bolt-action rifle, killing one detainee and injuring 2 others. Garcia was one of the struck detainees in the van, his hands and feet shackled together. Around 8 bullets tore into him, hitting his shoulder, stomach, tailbone, and neck, causing him to have a massive stroke. He was ultimately pulled from the van and rushed to Parkland Memorial Hospital in Dallas. The next time Goffini saw Garcia, he was in a hospital bed. His face was swollen, tubes snaked down his throat, staples closed a scar across his head. Dried blood dappled his face, neck, and bedsheets. His arms were restrained to bed, and his feet were shackled together at the ankles. He was unconscious. It was just awful to see him like that, she said. At a news conference on September 25th, federal officials said evidence indicated that the gunman was targeting ICE agents, not the detainees, before fatally shooting himself. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the September 30th issue of the Democrat and Chronicle. Your reader has been Barbara. Thank you for listening.